As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Everybody, and welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell, and today we're looking back at this week's Champions League action. To do so, I am joined by two wonderful gentlemen. Ryan Bailey is not going to be with us, but instead, up first is a man who, much like Ronald Koeman, is holding out to someday be paid 12 million euros. It's Graham Ruthven. Hi, Graham.
I mean, yes, I am holding out for that day. Ryan Bailey, taking another day. I mean, he's definitely got a pasta hangover for anyone who saw his tweet from last night. Either that or it was the alcoholic Iron Brews or Aperol Spritz, as they call them in Italy. Spritz. You're not fooling anyone, Italy.
What is a spritz? Yeah, Ryan was very proud of that order, and I still don't know what that is.
So, I have had Aperol Spritz, and I'm not entirely sure what it is. I mean, it tastes like a kind of fruity... I mean, it is not too dissimilar from Iron Brew. Italy are pulling the wool over our eyes.
Well, I'm assuming Ronald Koeman has had a cocktail or two since being sacked. That was what my introduction was alluding to. But I think he is due 12 million euros as a payout.
That's a lot of spritzes.
Yeah, exactly. But Graham, if you won't take the 12 million, if you can't get the 12 million, will you accept the two payments totaling 7.5 million euros that Koeman is now being offered?
Yeah, I'll accept that still.
Okay, cool. I'm glad. All right, sweet. Well, just go to Laporte for that one and Barcelona. I'm sure they'll pass that check right along. While Graham does that, I will also introduce Joe Lowry, a fellow who I'm assuming is ready to fight Angel Di Maria for having the audacity to be unkind to Tyler Adams. Joe, how are you feeling about that?
I have my boxing gloves on. I'm not going to lie, Taylor. I'm finding it slightly hard to be passionate about this issue when Graham just got 7.5 million euros and all I get to do is fight Angel Di Maria, who would probably beat me in a fight. So I guess I'll defend Tyler Adams' honor, but I'm not going to lie, I'm a little disappointed.
But Graham has to go get it from Barcelona. If you fight Angel Di Maria, I feel like then you could sue him. Maybe you get a payment there. And I think it all works out. So I think overall, the key thing here is both of you go out and hustle for a million.
Joe, I'm just spending the rest of my life outside the camp now. That's what my future holds. That's what Taylor has condemned me to.
It's a really good point. I don't feel so bad anymore, guys. Thank you.
I'm now picturing a small tent community outside of the Camp Nou for all of the Barcelona managers and players who have not been paid or been asked to take pay cuts. And similarly, one outside of Tottenham Stadium, where you have all of their former managers just hanging out.
Yeah. I think, oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, one can go to the other.
It's no coincidence that Ernesto Valverde, Kike Setien, they've not been seen since that. They're all camped outside waiting for their payoff.
Well, on that note, we are going to take a look at the Champions League that happened this week. We're going to start with Group A, Manchester City on top after their 4-1 win over Bruges, still not sure. PSG in second and had to battle for their 2-2 draw with Leipzig. Let's start there. Joe, which team do you think, broadly speaking, is happier with that result?
I think PSG is happier with that result, Taylor. Leipzig really needed points in this game. And sure, they got 1 point, but three would have been a lot better. They're at the bottom of this group. And I thought they outplayed PSG for large stretches of this game. And yes, this sounds very similar to the conversation we had on match day three, which had a very similar feeling where Leipzig were better in a lot of respects and PSG managed to get those individual moments and score goals. It's a similar pattern in this game, except I think Leipzig were even better in this game than they were on match day three. Fewer individual errors, at least in the first half of this game. They were really, really good, carving through PSG from the start. They took full advantage of the lack of defensive effort from PSG's front three in that 4-3-3 from Mauricio Pochettino. They were all over PSG at the start of this game, and even for stretches later on in the first half and in the second half, man, I think PSG has to feel pretty good coming out of this game with a point.
Graham, I'm assuming you were as impressed by Leipzig's start to this game or Leipzig's performance overall. What did you make of them, or more specifically, Nkunku in this game?
Yeah, I thought Nkunku was fantastic. Obviously, he scores the first goal in this match pretty early on. He gets across his man, flicks in a header, and he's a player who has, when I've watched him this season, seems to have added a different dimension to his game. So obviously, he's been a key player for Leipzig for a couple of seasons now, but previously he was very much the assists master for them. That was where he got a lot of numbers. Now he seems to be getting himself into more goal scoring positions, and he's had to do that because obviously Leipzig have sold a number of their best attackers in recent seasons, one of whom is now sitting on the Bayern Munich bench, and so other players have had to step up. And it's not really what I know. André Silva, he brings something to this Leipzig team, but I'm still not totally convinced by him. A slightly contradictory thing about this Leipzig performance was, as well as they started this match, they could have been 2-0 up. Obviously, Silva misses that penalty, and in that moment, you already feel like that's a key moment, even though Leipzig were well on top in that game. But as well as they started the match, I actually felt that it was towards the end of the second half when Who is it that comes on? It's Yusuf Poulsen, who comes on for Silva, and Szoboszlai comes on for Forsberg. And that front three of Szoboszlai, Poulsen, and Nkunku, that really seems like an attacking hub for Jesse Marsh to build around. And those three really, I thought they were playing well with each other. There was a good link between the midfield and attack at that point of the match. So it would have been interesting to see how different things might have been if those three had started the match. And I know that that's a bit of a paradox because Leipzig actually did start the match really well, but I just like that balance that they finished with.
That's really interesting because Silva, having to spend what they did to bring him in, for the new manager coming in, there's always that idea that, like, he needs to play the new player to show that he's, doing what's asked of him. He's not going back to playing, like, some academy player instead of the multi-million dollar player. But then you have Paulsen come on, you have Szoboszlai come on, who they obviously spent money on as well. But they do look a little bit more confident, a little bit more fluid, and I think they just have that Paulsen strength that you kind of have to account for.
Yeah, and Poulsen is just a player who, for me, gets better out of others around him, and that is really important for this Leipzig team. And when he's on the pitch, the goal scoring focus shifts slightly. So when Silva starts, he's very much the front man, and I know Nkunku helps him out with everything I've just said, but Silva's still a traditional number nine in the way that Leipzig don't really play, whereas Poulsen is more in their image, and then the goal scoring onus is on Szoboszlai and then Nkunku, and that just feels more apt for this Leipzig team. So I think we said a number of weeks ago that I would be surprised if Poulsen didn't start more games as the season went on, and that really hasn't happened. Silva is still playing from the start, so I'd like to hear a little bit more from Marsh on why that is the case.
Joe, Graham mentioned Leipzig having to sell on some of their best attackers. That is also the case for their defense. They lost both of their starting center backs from last season, but it seemed like they're making some progress on that front this season.
I certainly think so, and maybe, let me back up. This game is the perfect game for a center back. When you're playing against PSG, at least when your team has the ball, you know there's going to be green grass in front of you. Defending against PSG in transition is a completely different matter, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in just a minute. It's pretty much impossible to do. And so, you know, Simikan and Guardiola and Mukiele for the first stretch of this game, they have my sympathy for that particular task. But with the ball, man, when you play PSG and with the personnel that Leipzig have in their back line, they started in back three in this game, they were excellent at driving forward and breaking that first line for PSG, breaking past the front line, driving into midfield to initiate a transition attack or to initiate a possession attack. Simikan and Guardiola, who the center back and left center back for Jesse Marsh respectively, they were really excellent in this game at getting on the ball and carrying it forward and progressing play and cueing those moments for Leipzig to really go. I think those players are so important to Jesse March and Simikhan in particular. They're both young players, but Simikhan in particular is vulnerable and will make a mistake and do a little bit too much on the ball. To an extent, you kind of have to take that with the good. You have to take the bad with the good from Simikhan, because in a game like this, you can see just how important they are. Of course, there is a PSG side where if you have a front three of Mbappe, Neymar, and Di Maria, like Pochettino used in this game, and you can toss Messi in there too in another game, and it's going to be the same result. Those players really don't do much defending in that front line, which causes PSG all sorts of problems. It also benefits them in certain ways. So it's trade-offs everywhere, and Leipzig, I thought, did a good job of taking advantage of one of PSG's biggest weaknesses with their centre-back personnel.
Did anyone see the clip of Neymar? So PSG are, it seems like they're quite compact. They're not pressing high. They're staying compact, asking RB Leipzig to play through them. And in the middle of that shape, Neymar just decides he's going to kneel down and tie his shoelace.
Yeah.
Did anyone see that? And then Leipzig are like, well, okay, we're going to take this route through the middle of your team.
Oh my gosh.
Which, it just kind of sums up this PSG team at the moment a little bit.
It's almost comical, Graham. Like, moments like that are on the extreme side, for sure. But they happen a bunch of times every single game. And the crazy thing is PSG are so, so good with the ball. They're not at their peak right now. I think Poch could be doing more with this team in terms of structuring how they defend and setting them up to absorb pressure a little bit better. But, man, PSG can actually just give up in that front line and not have to do a whole lot and still get a result. They were not the better team in this game, I would argue, and they could have been down 2-0, like we mentioned, inside the first 15 minutes. And we'd probably be talking about them a little bit differently, PSG. But oh my word, the talent they have to still essentially just take a break in one phase of the game and attack and cause problems for the other team in another phase of the game is ridiculous.
Joe, you said Poch could be doing more with this team. And I'm sure you're talking about like the tactics, but it begs the question for me that I have in my notes multiple times from this game and others is basically like, how do you tell Messi what to do if you are his manager? Like, and I know there is all of these people are famous, all of these people are celebrities, and all of these people are renowned for their footballing ability or their coaching ability. But to have Lionel Messi come in, I cannot fathom trying to get him to play in a system and trying to get him to do things he doesn't want to do. And not trying to paint him as the villain or anything. It's just that when he has the level of fame and success that he has and has had, I don't know how you sort of come in and treat him like any other player and try to get him to press and counter-press. It feels like you sort of have to account for Messi doing what Messi wants to do, almost.
You do, and I would argue the same thing goes for Neymar, certainly, and probably for Mbappe as well, Taylor. These are players that have very defined skill sets and are elite in every sense of that term. They're phenomenal players, but I would be shocked, like you're saying, if they are extremely receptive or overly receptive to instruction. And so if you're Poch, you probably know that when you're taking the PSG job, right? You don't know that necessarily you're going to sign Messi, which complicates things a little bit more. But even in a game like this where we don't see Messi at all on the field, you still see those problems. You can see, okay, if this is Liverpool and it's Mane and Salah and Firmino or Diogo Jota up top, those guys are going to press. They're going to buy in under Klopp. I think these players that PSG has in their front line, maybe Angel Di Maria aside, they're a level above that in a sense. And you don't really expect them to buy in. And maybe you can get them to buy in. Maybe you can't. But odds are they're going to do their thing. And so what I think what Poch can improve is how he structures the group behind them, right? How are they able to apply pressure to the ball in midfield? How are they able to absorb pressure when the opposing team's center backs are driving forward? How can they avoid getting carved up like they did in the first 30 minutes of this game? And to be fair, we did see some improvement from PSG. One of the first big chances they have comes in the 38th minute. It's a super dangerous counterattack that starts with Mbappe winning the ball deep back on the right side for PSG, playing it up to Neymar. Neymar then plays it up to Wijnaldum, who plays it over to Di Maria, who hits a volley that goes out for a corner. 2 minutes later, that's the goal, or 1 minute later, that's the goal that Wijnaldum scores off the corner that goes to VAR after the Marquinhos header that Wijnaldum puts home. Those chances for PSG do start when they have a slightly more structured defensive block that then they're counterattacking out of. We need to see more of those sequences, or Poch needs to see more of those sequences if he wants to get this team playing at their full ability.
Graham, a couple of specific moments that I'd like to ask you about, starting with the penalty conceded that Silva bundled into, knocked over, he takes the penalty, saved by Donnarumma. I think he read that the entire time.
Yeah.
But the penalty itself, Danilo gets a yellow card, and it was debated by the commentators when I was watching. I am still a little bit confused because I know with Dog So, you're not giving a red card and the penalty, except if the player hasn't made a legitimate play on the ball. And I would argue Danilo does not do that. I think Danilo just sort of barges into Silva knowing he's not going to be able to make a play. And I think sort of assuming like, oh, well, I'll give a penalty up, but at least it's not going to be a red card. I feel like that could have been a red.
Yeah, and that was the kind of first incident in a night of strange refereeing decisions across the board. Because, of course, there was the Hummels red card, which I think we'll probably talk about. And then there's the Felipe red card at Anfield as well. Those two were even more contentious. But I totally agree. Like, Danilo doesn't, for me anyway, doesn't make a play on the ball. And so, yeah, that was debated on our coverage as well, that probably should have been a red card. And if that is a red card, then that changes the game completely, particularly for a team like PSG, where they're already sacrificing so much to get those game it was two attackers, you know. But Danilo's one of the few players that actually gives them some structure, so him going off might have been a problem.
And then Silva, as I said, misses the penalty. I did not watch this live, so I knew he was going to miss it when I watched it on the replay. Strange question.
I did watch it live, and I knew he was going to miss it.
Okay, that's my question. That is my question. The face he's making, there is a world in which that is a very focused, like, nothing can break my concentration. I know exactly what I'm doing. But when you know he misses, I find myself watching that thinking, like, does he look terrified? Because he sort of looks terrified. This is the strange question I have for you, Graham Ruthven. And then, Joe, I welcome your response as well. What is the face you want to see, like, your team? If Scotland get a penalty that they have to take, like, they have to convert to make the World Cup, what do you want whoever, Kieran Tierney's face, if he steps up, or Billy Gilmore, if he steps up, what should their face look like? Is it calm? Is it relaxed? Is it smiling? Is it that level of focus? Like, what makes you feel like this guy has got this?
Well, I mean, you obviously want a calm expression, but the line between calm and terrified is quite a thin one. So if that were me, maybe I would just, like, do a big grin, like, to try and put the goalkeeper off in some way. Or John McGinn, you said, like, a Scotland penalty. John McGinn has this habit of putting his fingers around his eyes like he's imitating glasses. He does that quite a weird number of times, actually. So maybe like that.
Before he takes the penalty, he puts his
I've never seen him before a penalty, but I've seen him mid-game do it he's making a pass or whatever.
All right. Joe, any thoughts on that one? Do you want, like, a grinning penalty taker?
Oh, I want a wry smile all day long. The confidence that portrays, I could never, and I have never. I've taken one penalty in an important game, and I was terrified. I made it, but I was terrified. I tried to play it off pretty well. I did not have the guts to pull off the wry smile. It was not, Graham. Good gracious. That would have been incredible, though. Wow. Now I'm just regretting every choice I've ever made. Thank you for that. But I would like a wry smile from whoever is taking that penalty on the U.S. men's national team.
So Joe would like a wry smile. Speaking of smiles, the next random but obvious question, is the friendliness from Donnarumma and Neymar genuine or not? Because Donnarumma smiling throughout this game, smiling with the referee, but still having those moments where it's like, me? What? I didn't do anything. And then he goes back to smiling. Neymar the same. Neymar talking to Tyler Adams. He's talking to Szoboszlai before Szoboszlai takes the pen. And it seems friendly, but also maybe is some head games. Joe, what do you think? Is there genuine friendliness from those two?
It could be friendliness in the run of play, but that penalty specifically, I'm thinking of Szoboszlai's penalty. Neymar is trying to get in his head. There is no way that's a genuine, hey, should we actually hang out later? Like, you want to play FIFA or something? There's no chance that's what's happening. I read through some of the post-match quotes from this game, and Szoboszlai said that Neymar was asking him, hey, are you going to score? And Szoboszlai said, yes, I am. And Neymar's like, are you sure? And Szoboszlai said, I never miss. And I don't know if that's actually what happened or not. We're not really privy to that information.
It definitely
for sure
is what happened.
But it feels like what happened, right? That. And that's not like does. Hey, Hungarian friend, you're going to score this, right? Like, I want it to happen for you. No, it's mind games.
He was inviting him to his sister's birthday party in Brazil.
Joe, I'm so, first of all, I hope it was the birthday invite. That would be very genuinely nice. But second, Joe, I'm really happy that you did that reading, because I did not, but I've watched that clip over and over, and that's exactly what it seems like. Because he makes that sort of, like, eyebrow raise, like, you sure? You sure you're going to make it? And I thought, I thought he was asking him, which side are you going to go? And then was sort of giving him notes on like, are you sure? Are you sure that's what you want to do? But it's interesting to have that explanation. So thank you for that. So Graham, do you agree with Joe then that maybe Donnarumma genuine, Neymar, some gamesmanship?
See, I missed the Neymar and Tyler Adams stuff that you're talking about.
Okay.
What happened there? Like, I saw the Donnarumma stuff and the Neymar stuff for the penalty with Szoboszlai, yeah. But was he just in Tyler Adams' ear the whole match? Or
what? No, it's so Tyler Adams has the incident with Angel Di Maria. Adams picks up a yellow card, is suspended for their next game, and it's basically that like Adams is doing what Adams does on the defensive side. He's sort of jockeying Angel Di Maria. There's a little bit of physicality to it. There's some back and forth, and Di Maria I think feels that he's been fouled. The referee doesn't give the foul. So then Leipzig get possession off of that. The ball goes back to Tyler Adams. And as he's passing the ball, Angel Di Maria comes kind of charging in, gives him a little shoulder. Tyler Adams reacts by shoving him. Di Maria goes down like he's been shot. And it's the yellow card given. And it's Neymar is the first one there, or one of the first ones there. And he is sort of almost consoling Adams, like he has his arms around him. They're very, very close in talking. He's got his like hand on the back of Tyler Adams' head. And for the first little bit, it feels like, oh, like maybe he's saying like, ah, you know, he dove, but you can't react like that or whatever. And the more it went on, the more it felt like he's being very handsy. And I wonder if he is sort of trying to annoy Tyler Adams so that Adams will shove him away and get that second yellow. So it felt friendly, but also threatening at the same time.
Yeah, as well. That's the scenario is flipped to a famous case that happened a few years ago between a Celtic right back called Anthony Ralston, who responded to Neymar's diving by just laughing in his face every time he did it. And there's quite a famous picture where his expression is a friendly one, but verging into terrifying and mocking at the same time. So maybe Neymar got that from Anthony Ralston.
Isn't that just what the Scottish people call smiling?
Yes. Well, okay. That's actually more than I do. That would be friendly for me.
Lovely. Gentlemen, anything else on this game?
I'll add just how scary PSG are. Even on a day where they're not at their best and not playing to their full ability, they had a rough start and they struggled to build up from the back and they struggled to defend early on. But man, it does not take much for them to get going. They have so much quality. We see it on the first goal. We see it in the build-up to the second goal. We see it in a handful of other moments in this game. Mbappe is just faster than anyone on the field. Hakimi is likely faster than anyone on the opposition's defense. It's a hard team to stop, and I don't see many teams out of really Europe's elite right now being able to stop PSG.
I thought Wijnaldum's position in this game was quite interesting. Like he seemed to be playing in a more advanced role, and we've all been assuming that if he was getting into that team, it would be more as the Liverpool player that we saw. But actually, maybe Poch sees him more as the Netherlands player, which you know is quite something, given the balance of his midfield. That Pochettino sees a potential, not so much an anchor, but someone who can play centrally as an attacking option. I'm not sure that's what you need, Poch. More attackers. But in this particular game, I thought Wijnaldum did quite well.
I think you all have both done quite well discussing that game. We will be back to discuss more Champions League in just a moment.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints,
both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. Welcome back on with our Champions League review. Liverpool booked their place in the knockout round with a 2-0 win over Atletico Madrid, who had Felipe sent off in somewhat dubious fashion. Atletico now third in the group with 4 points. Ahead of them is Porto with 5 after their 1-1 draw at Milan. Graham, let's pause for a moment to talk about that Felipe red card. You mentioned it previously. Also a little bit confusing, I think, for people watching at home, for people in the stands, and maybe for Felipe as well, who didn't quite seem to understand that he'd been red carded for the first minute or so that the card was produced.
Yeah, there was a lot of confusion about this incident. So it's Mane, isn't it? He's kind of racing away on the counter-attack. Felipe is the Atletico Madrid defender, and he kind of fouls him in that cynical way you frequently see a defender do when they are out of position and could be exposed at the back. He's basically taking one for the team. That's how they say, you know, he's taking a yellow card. However, the replay kind of shows that he stands on Mane's, I'm not going to say stamp because it wasn't quite as violent as that, but he stands on Mane's heel kind of with the front of his studs. And then it seemed like the referee got the red card out initially. Then it seemed like he was going to give him a yellow card, and then he's calling to Felipe, and Felipe is ignoring him and not coming to him. And then all of a sudden the referee just decides he's going to give him the red card. And the confusion came from, there was a lot of people on Twitter saying that that Felipe had actually been given the red card for ignoring the referee and the instructions of the official, which is actually in the laws of the game. I didn't know that until last night. But actually, UEFA have clarified that it was not for Felipe's ignorance. It was actually for the challenge. And so in my book, it was quite a harsh red card, if that was the case.
Wait, can you clarify that? So I knew that you can get a straight red if you are, like, over-the-top foul and abusive towards an official. You can get a red card for just, like, walking away and ignoring.
But I did not know that, but I think it was Adam Crafton, who's a reporter for The Athletic. He copied and he screenshot a section of the laws from FIFA or IFAB, I presume. And, yeah, he'd highlighted a section for ignoring the officials. It's a red card offence, yeah, which I guess is just a part of the laws that is never used. But it seemed like the referee had used it in this case, but UEFA have clarified that it actually wasn't that. But it was a confusing incident all round, really.
All right, so Joe, no putting fingers in the ears and walking away when the ref is trying to talk to you.
Ah, fine, Taylor. It's such a buzzkill. Golly.
I apologize. Let's talk about the next group. Joining Liverpool in the knockout round is Ajax, who picked up a 12 of a possible 12 points in their first four games. That's fairly impressive. They got a 3-1 come-from-behind win over 10-man Dortmund. Sporting Lisbon thrashed Besiktas 4-0. But it's Ajax and Dortmund we're going to spend some time with. Graham, I'm coming to you for the obvious TSS kit watch. If you're giving out letter grades for this game, what are you giving Ajax and what are you giving Dortmund?
So I actually own this Ajax shirt this season.
You say that about every jersey we talk about.
As if it's some sort of surprise, Graham. Exactly. We just assume that that's the case.
So what I love about this Ajax, it's pretty standard for Ajax, other than the retro crest, which is why I bought it. So for that reason alone, it's getting an A. And the Dortmund third kit is a complete travesty,
yep.
And is getting an F. And Joe, did I see you tweeting about the Dortmund
kit last
night?
I'm so happy you saw. I almost sent a follow up tweet at you. And I was going to at you and say, Graham, are you proud of me? But I was hoping it was going to come up on this show. Thank you so much for noticing, Graham. That made my day.
Yeah, I know. I've got an alert set up anytime anyone from TSS talks about kits.
Wait, what was the tweet?
A light flashes on my wall.
Oh, my
like
gosh.
Ghostbusters.
That's so good. Taylor, I'm trying to find exactly what I said, but it was something to the effect of, wow, I cannot believe how genuinely... Oh, here we go. I genuinely can't believe how bad Bruce Dortmund's third kid is. Good gracious me. It's so bad. And I've seen it before. Like, I've seen all of these Puma third kits. They're horrible. This is the worst one by a mile. This one sells for $6 at Ross, Taylor.
It's the Puma one, right? Where it says like Dortmund.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Okay. It's not great. So that jersey, a little lackluster. Joe, Ajax, a little lackluster in that first half. Or was it Dortmund being very good?
Yes. I think yes. Several of the Ajax players and Erik ten Hag after the game mentioned how they weren't good in the first half. And that's true. I think we can all agree on that. Far too sloppy with the ball. They didn't take care of it enough. And even when they did have the ball, they weren't especially dangerous at breaking through Borussia Dortmund's block from Marco Rosa. So there's that side of things. And thankfully for Ajax, at least, things did turn around a little bit in the second half. And of course, they get those three goals to get all 3 points. But for Dortmund's side of things, I thought they were excellent in the first half. Even after they lose Mats Hummels to a red card, they were controlling the game, not necessarily with the ball, but with their defensive work. They started out in this high press that we've seen from Marco Rosa in the past, and we've certainly seen it from his Dortmund team this year. They started in a 4-3-3 shape, right? But it shifts into more of a 4-4-2 diamond when they press. So in this game, it was a 4-4-2 with Julian Brandt moving from right center mid up to the 10 spot in the diamond, and then it was Thorgan Hazard dropping from the right wing to right center mid to form the right tip of that diamond. Marco Reus then joined the front line to form a front two, and they were really having some success. It then left Axel Witsel as the six and Jude Bellingham as the left-sided number eight. So you have that diamond in front of the back four with the front two. And that almost completely stymied Ajax's ability to build up. They really struggled to break past that press. And then when Dortmund did drop a little bit deeper and Ajax had some more room to breathe, Dortmund did an excellent job stepping forward out of their 4-5-1 mid-block. They would drop about to the midfield line, and they'd have the nine a little bit above that line, and they'd have the wingers tucked in a little bit inside, and it was a solid, compact shape. But they didn't just sit there and react. Over and over again, they would send pressure out of that mid-block, right? Like, really incisive, calculated pressure. Julian Brandt was the player I noticed doing it most, but Jude Bellingham did it on the opposite side of central midfield as well. Brandt or Bellingham would step forward and apply pressure to the ball, and it took Ajax by surprise. Dortmund then could surround the rest of the passing options so that the ball presser could really, really harm the ball carrier for Ajax. And Dortmund did this over and over again in the first half. Even after they went down to 10 men, they still had success doing this in a 4-4-1 defensive block. I was just really impressed by what I saw from Dortmund in this first half. And for them, it's kind of a shame that it didn't extend into the second 45.
And that's a different side to Dortmund than we've seen this season. It's actually one of the criticisms that has been made under Marco Rosa this season is that they haven't been able to maintain a shape or you know, kind of show some defensive steals for them to instantly snap into this in this match was pretty impressive. Joe, I was going to ask you how much of everything that you described there. So the two players that stood out to me when they went down to 10 men were the two that you mentioned there, Bellingham and Julian Brandt. How much of that is down to the intelligence of those two players? Because that's something that certainly stands out for me about Brandt. I've always thought of him as quite an intelligent player who can do a number of different things. Bellingham, pretty much everything stands out about him. I think he is absolutely outstanding. So was Rosa quite fortunate in that he did have players who could actually respond to that situation?
I think so, for sure, Graham. Those two players, you can see in how they move when Dortmund are in possession, but also when they're defending and stepping out of that mid-block and when they're pressing it and they know their rotations and they know what they need to cover in terms of ground defensively. They're clearly very, very smart players. And I do want to give credit to Marco Rosa. I'd be shocked if there wasn't an element of coaching there in terms of drilling those rotations and drilling those defensive movements and the movements in possession as well. But yeah, I mean, I was extremely impressed by Jude Bellingham, as I always am. And I was really, really impressed with Julian Brandt as well. He plays a fantastic ball into the box for Bellingham that leads to Marco Reus's penalty goal in the 37th minute. That's the goal that puts Borussia Dortmund up in this game and really does put them in the driver's seat in a sense, even though they're down a man. Just really impressive contributions on both sides of the ball from both of those central midfielders for Dortmund.
So we're praising Dortmund quite a little bit, Joe. But it is a Dortmund team that end up losing. Do you feel like a large percentage of that can be put on the red card and Mats Hummels being sent off?
Maybe. This is one of those questions about soccer that I never am fully sure how to answer. When you go down to 10 men, how does that affect the game? In some senses, sure, it makes things easier for the other team and harder for your team, of course. But at the same time, Ajax were already having trouble breaking through Borussia Dortmund's mid-block. Then you take a player off and encourage Dortmund to sit even deeper and to really concede possession to Ajax, which is a phase of play for Ajax that they haven't been especially dominant in this season. They have been dominant, don't get me wrong, in Europe and in the Eredivisie. But when they have the ball, they don't always have a ton of clear chances coming from their possession setup. So in this game, I don't know if you're Erik ten Hag, how thrilled you are to have Dortmund go down a man. Yes, it allows you to really settle the ball and maybe calm down a little bit in possession. But in some senses, it makes your life harder, too.
Graham, two questions about that red card for you. First off, the commentators over here referred to it as an agricultural challenge. Can you remind our listeners, I believe that is a Britishism, what that means?
Just a rough tackle, shall we say.
I don't really know
what the root of it is. That's maybe a cliche that I should research. But yeah, it pretty much means a rough tackle that could cause some damage to an opposition player, an agricultural tackle.
I think we've explained it once on the show before, and it could have various different meanings. I welcome listeners to look it up and decide for themselves. But the second question, Graham, I thought this was going to be overturned because it's given as a straight red. Yeah. Watching it again, Hummels, like the foot is elevated for sure, but it's sliding through. He kind of wins the ball, if anything. So I would have been like, maybe you can give that as a foul. Maybe it's a yellow card, but I wouldn't have had too much beef if it had just been given as a foul. So for it to be a straight red and then stand as a straight red, despite VAR, I'm assuming, getting in Michael Oliver's ear, that seemed odd to me. Were you surprised by that decision?
Yeah, a little bit. I can see why, same as you, I can see why it was given. You know, Hummels, when he goes into the tackle, is quite high. His foot is elevated, as you put it. But there's also, who is the tackle on again? I can't even remember, but whoever the player is Anthony, right? So Anthony kind of also ends up stamping on Hummels' legs as well. So there's both players engaging in an agricultural sense. But yeah, I was surprised this one stood, but it was a night of peculiar refereeing decisions, I think.
And since we've mentioned Anthony, let's continue to mention him because
he's
real good. He real good.
Graham,
good. Is he our next like big Brazilian, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think this Ajax team, obviously everyone is looking for a superstar to come out of it, and that's maybe a little bit unfair because they are more than corny, but they are more of the sum of their parts. So but he's the guy that I think he's the player who's going to come out of this. He's going to get a 50 million euro move to one of the, I know Ajax are a big club, but one of the super clubs. And the way Ten Hag has him playing just reminds me of Sancho for Dortmund, in the way that he is a one man attacking hub. He can go on the outside, he can hit the byline, but he also likes to cut inside, get shots away. I think the thing that is most reminiscent of Sancho is the way that he'll cut inside, he'll kind of shape to shoot, you'll think he's going to take on the shot, and then he'll kind of play a little reverse ball behind the defence for a teammate, for an attacker. That's what Sancho used to do for Dortmund, and Anthony does that a lot for Ajax. So yeah, he's really good, and I think I texted you last night just to rub salt on the wound, so I wonder what Ten Hag would do with Sancho at Manchester United if this is what he's doing with Anthony at Ajax.
I'm not going to lie. When I went to respond to that, I did pause for a moment to think, wait, has Ten Hag been hired? You did get my hopes up, Graham, so thank you for that. Anthony definitely got my hopes up in terms of seeing exciting football because he has the assist for the third, he has the assist for the second. I would even give him credit for the equalizer because he plays the ball in that's kind of flicked onto the back post by a Dortmund player and then it's put in. So he is heavily involved in all three goals. And yet, Joe, maybe we need to give some credit to David Klaassen because he comes on in the second half and that's when things sort of turn around. Do you have thoughts on why David Klaassen sort of changes the face of this game?
Well, let's back up maybe just a step here.
Fine.
Klaassen comes on for Edson Álvarez, I think largely because Álvarez is already on a yellow card for a challenge on Jude Bellingham in the first half. And so Klaassen comes on in the second half, and that pushes Ryan Gravenberg a little bit deeper in midfield. I still generally keep their same shape, But I think it was a logical sub from Ten Hag, not just because of the yellow card for Alvarez, but because they did need a little bit more quality on the ball. I hesitate to use that term because Alvarez is a very skilled player, but he's more of a six or a center back hybrid than he is a six or an eight or a guy you really want operating between the lines. So having Davy Klaassen on the field in the second half gives Ajax another option between the lines. It gives them more opportunities to progress the ball and have Gravenberg as that single pivot that Ajax so often uses, with Daley Blind tucking in to form the back three with the two center backs, Timber and Martinez. So you've got that back three, then you've got Gravenberg as the single pivot, and then you almost got six players in the front line. And one of those six players could then be Davy Klaassen, and then you have Gravenberg who can progress from deeper. So I think the personnel swap and the skill sets that were presented in the second half for Ajax made a lot more sense, and that does sort of play out given the scoreline in the second half.
And I'm assuming, Joe, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer made equally impressive tactical substitutions and changed the face of the game for like his own part?
Oh, yes, of course, Taylor. Let's pivot the Ajax conversation once more to Manchester United, shall we?
I mean, I think we probably should.
We actually should, yes.
So one of the differences between, and I will take this back to Ajax, but watching, I know we're going to talk about the Man United game later, but they're obviously chasing a late goal, and Ajax were chasing goals in this game with a man advantage. But it's quite traditional for a team chasing a goal late on to pile players into the box and have them all on top of each other. And Manchester United did that against Atalanta. But one of the impressive things about the way Ajax chased the goal in this game, and yes, they were playing crosses into the box and long balls into the box, but one of the key things that they do is the bodies that are in the box take up separate positions to each other. So even though that ball is going into the box, there's still space for them to do things. And that was obvious for me in the last two goals they scored, the second and the third goal, is that it's not just a traditional throw everyone into the box. Everyone in the box knows what area of the box they're meant to be in, and so it just creates more problems for the opposition defense. It's a slightly different take on just putting crosses in there.
There's like a determined relentlessness to the way that Ajax seem to attack, and I take your point, Graham, that other teams will just throw everything at it and try to kind of make the other team bend to that pressure. Whereas with Ajax, it reminds me of like the early, like Michael Myers, like the slasher movies, where you're never going to see him run. There's just going to be this relentless determination. And then eventually they're very quick at the very, very end. And then I guess one team is defeated is how I'm going to continue that metaphor. But yeah, like just the way.
I was wondering how you're going to end that one.
Awkwardly, I think is the answer. But just like the way like Anthony sets up that third goal, it is just a stand up, a little shimmy, and then it is a ball in. But there's just something different to beating somebody 1v1 to then play that ball in, but play it in a very calm, like it's in swinging from the right hand side, and just the way he puts it on Haller's head. Haller obviously getting pulled quite a little bit there. That might be for the second goal.
Yeah, second goal.
It's still just, it's such a pretty sort of like ruthlessness that Ajax seem to bring to the equation, and it makes them really, really fun to watch.
I was just going to say very quickly, and I think Haller is the ideal striker for that. I compared him to Lewandowski in the role he plays for Bayern Munich. It's similar for him in this Ajax team. He brings something slightly different, a little bit of incision, and sometimes he isn't so concerned with how he gets the ball into the back of the net, as demonstrated by this header where he kind of flicks it with the back of his head. I always think that's an incredible skill when a player does that. It looks a little bit awkward, but it's very hard to pull off. And so he's the perfect frontman for this Ajax team. I think he's up to 7 goals in the Champions League this season, which is quite incredible.
Well, he's scored in every single game, hasn't he?
And he's had a hat trick in a game, hasn't he? I think.
Oh, wow. Okay. He's doing okay. Joe, I know you wanted to say something, but first I wanted to say, Joe, did you want to say something?
Oh, I would, Taylor. Thank you so much. That's really kind of you. I wanted to do one more beat on Anthony here. I pulled up his stats on FBref. This is based off of almost 900 minutes in the Champions League and in the Europa League. His numbers are really good. He's in the 95th percentile among attacking midfielders and wingers in terms of open play, non-penalty expected goals plus expected assists. He is in the 95th percentile in terms of progressive carries. He's in the 98th percentile in terms of progressive passes received. He's just a hugely impactful player in the attack, getting on the ball, bringing it forward, driving it forward, progressing on the dribble and on the pass, and then actually creating chances for his teammates and for himself. This game is the poster child, really, for that statistical analysis from FBref. He is an extremely talented young player.
So congratulations to Anthony for that. Congratulations to Ajax for booking their place in the knockout round. We will be back to round out our Champions League coverage in just a moment. First, I'm going to go daydream about Anthony playing for Manchester United, and then we'll be back.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Welcome back to the Total Soccer Show. During that break, Graham said hurtful things about Manchester United and what would happen if they signed Anthony. So instead, I'm going to go back to Graham to let him talk about a celebration he particularly enjoyed. Hi, Graham.
Oh, I don't even know how I'm going to describe this one, but all I'll say is Dusan Tadic's celebration for the equaliser for Ajax against Dortmund was iconic, and I hope it's in the next FIFA.
You don't even want to try to describe it?
Let's just say he hurts himself in a delicate part of the body. The funniest thing about it was that I think most people would try and kind of hide it, but he's giving it fist pumps while he is going back to that delicate part of his body to, how shall we say, cup certain things.
I forgot you sent that to the group, that clip. You also sent us another solid one relating to Group D, where Real Madrid are on top 9 points, Inter just behind on 7. Sheriff fell to third after they lost to Inter, which, Graham, to go back to what I was saying, I think has a nominee for pun of the year.
Oh, that was James Richardson. So when Inter score their second goal, James Richardson, who does the BT Sport coverage over here, says, they think it's Moldova. It is now, which is a fantastic pun, and I can only presume made Ryan Bailey very jealous that he did not think of it.
I think there was, Ryan put a hole through a wall somewhere, realizing what could have been if he had come up with that one on his own. Hopefully not, though. Hopefully not. Bayern Munich sitting top of the table, as they tend to do. They're also perfect through the first four games. They only have a measly 17 goals for and a whopping 2 against, so that might not be enough. We'll see if they can sort of figure some things out. Barcelona 6 points behind, but I hear Laporte is negotiating for that to just be 4 points behind. We'll see how that works out. That brings us to Group F, which has Manchester United top ahead of Villarreal on goal difference. Both teams on 7 points, Atalanta third with 5, which means, Joe, Ole is good now, I'm guessing?
Taylor, no. Yeah, I'm sorry. I so badly want to tell you something that is going to make you happy. This game, I think, maybe will make you happy in certain parts. The equalizer, the late equalizer, is a huge opportunity for Manchester United that they capitalize on. And I thought the first half, from a pure soccer standpoint, was extremely fun, right? This game was end-to-end a little bit. There was some nice moments from each team. Josip Ilicic gets that first goal for Atalanta in the 12th minute, and then Manchester United have the equalizer before halftime. And I just enjoyed the rhythm of this first half. The second half quieted down quite a bit, I thought. There were still plenty of impressive moments. But man, this first 45, especially that first Manchester United team goal, it was fun to watch, Taylor.
Let's talk about that goal then for a second, because it did feel like a as you said, a team goal, whereas the second is mostly Ronaldo with a great hit. But the first one, it's good combination play. That felt a bit more like a team that has sort of practiced patterns of play and how to move the ball quickly and kind of make those decisive passes. I thought it was pretty solid from the start of the move to the back of the net.
I agree. It was a nice sequence for Manchester United. I'll detail it here quickly, and then I'm going to fight back slightly on that, Taylor. I'm so sorry.
Oh boy.
So they're moving the ball. Manchester United moving the ball around in the final third, combining a little bit. Pogba plays it centrally to McSauce. McSauce plays it to Bruno. Bruno to Ronaldo. Ronaldo to Greenwood. Greenwood to Bruno, who made this phenomenal run off the ball. This run that really blindsided Atalanta's back line. And Bruno then touches it back to Ronaldo, who finishes. And as we've said, it was a phenomenal team shooting goal, and Bruno's run for me completely makes this play. It's a run in behind direct, and it gets behind Demiral, the center back for Atalanta. It's a great understanding from Bruno, and really from Manchester United, of how to beat a man-oriented defensive system. We talked about this before. We talked about this when we discussed Atalanta last on this show. They defend man-to-man in certain situations, right? They have those principles that Gasperini has instilled into this group. They tend to hang tighter to an individual player and an individual opponent defensively than almost any top-flight team does, Leeds being an exception, and I guess San Jose at times being an exception in Major League Soccer. But they're more man-oriented in open play than almost any other team in the world. And it makes them exciting to watch, and it presents this element of chaos defensively. But it can also leave them exposed. And Manchester United, credit to them, they do expose that. And in the way that I think is best suited to actually expose a team like that is with this direct off-ball running. We saw it some in the first meeting between these two teams in this group on match day 3. And this is probably the best example of it with that Bruno run. If you're running hard towards goal, the likelihood of your marker, the opponent, the Atalanta player who's marking you, the likelihood that they're going to be able to stick with you and still watch the ball and watch you at the same time, it's not very likely. The odds are pretty low, and Bruno does a fantastic job of evading pressure and really causing problems in this play. The part that I wanted to hit back, Taylor, slightly on is the idea that this is a defined pattern of play. Maybe it is against a team that does defend like Atalanta defends, but I still don't see a ton of coordinated, pre-planned ball movement. I see a lot of really good improvisation. And even on the second goal, we see that more on an individual level rather than a team level. I see this goal, though, as good players doing really good things, like we saw with PSG, to be honest, but less of, oh, Ole has a plan now. This is a defined pattern that they've been training and working on. And so I think there still is that distinction. I don't have a lot of confidence in Manchester United when it comes time for them to actually show those sustained patterns of play. Their individuals can get them a long way. They really can. That's why Manchester United are still towards the top of the table in the Premier League. But I don't see a lot of Ole's influence really shaping this team right now.
Graham, two questions for you. First off, why is Joe so mean? And then second of all, why does it have to be this way with Paul Pogba?
I think Paul Pogba might actually be finished this time. I know we've said that so many... I mean, as a Manchester United player... I know we've been here so many times before. It's tiring the number of times we've been here before. But yeah, I think the way it's shaping up now, it does feel like, just looking at his body language, even if it's subconsciously, he's not engaged with the task at all. He's taking so many touches of the ball in almost every game he plays. It was certainly a problem against he didn't play against Liverpool, did he? But when he came off the bench at halftime, it was a problem. When he was on the pitch, it was a problem in this match. Yeah, I if I were Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and at this point he is just purely picking teams to save his job, which is why I would say he's right at the moment not to play Jadon Sancho, even though it is ridiculous that he's chased that player for 2 years and he doesn't have a plan for him. But having a plan for him is going to take some time to devise, and Solskjaer doesn't have time right now. And by the same token, I think it's similar with Paul Pogba. I don't know where he fits into this team at the moment, but Solskjaer doesn't really have time to work it out. So I would be putting players in that you know are going to do a job, and Pogba at the moment is just not one of them.
Graham, would it make it better to know that Paul Pogba did play against Liverpool and came on as a halftime substitute and then got a red card immediately? Does that make you think he's doing better?
No, not really.
Well then, Graham, while we're sticking with the things that make me sad about the club that I support, let's talk about Harry Maguire for a second, because that's another one who felt like...
Do you really want to?
Here's what I would like to do. I would like to have a conversation about why... If you have an idea about why things seem to sort of be intermittently working and how it is that, like, parts can work but then other parts don't, and maybe the larger question I would like to ask both of you is, this is coming, I would acknowledge, purely from a, like, fandom perspective, but we know that after the Liverpool game, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer given 3 games to turn things around. There's the win over Spurs, who then fired their manager, so make of that what you will. Then there's this draw. It's a good fight back, but I would say it's not necessarily the most, I don't know, reassuring results. So then there's Man City on the weekend. What do you all think, like, needs to happen for him to sort of solidify that position? Is it a draw versus City? Is it a win versus City? What do you think are the steps that need to kind of be taken, or the things that need to occur for Ole to continue to be there?
Well, I think he needs to avoid another heavy defeat. Just reading the reports in the British press, and I don't really have any inside information at all, but it feels like United still aren't really strongly considering alternatives. They had a look at Conte, it seems like, but obviously now he's gone to Spurs, so that option has gone. And so it would really take another mauling like the one against Liverpool. If that happens, I think he is in trouble and he probably will be sacked, even if Manchester United don't have a plan. But I think even if it's a narrow defeat, Solskjaer still keeps his job. But I do think the big problem from this match, for me talking about the derby, is the fact that Varane comes out injured, because just on an individual basis, Varane makes such a difference to this team, in my opinion. I don't think it's a coincidence that he comes back for the Spurs game and they keep a clean sheet. Obviously, there was a tactical shift there to a back three as well. Varane comes out of this game, and Maguire and Eric Bailly. I actually think Eric Bailly actually had a decent game on an individual basis. I think he's certainly playing on the evidence of this match, he's playing better than Maguire, but the relationship between Maguire and Bailly wasn't there either. The second Atalanta goal, the Zapata goal, it's bizarre because United start this match in a back three with Varane in the back line there. Then he comes out for Greenwood, so Solskjaer switches it to a back four. But if you look at Maguire's positioning for that second Atalanta goal, it's almost like he's still playing in a back three positionally. The area of the pitch that he's holding would be the area of the pitch if he was in that back three. So it's just mental sharpness for me is the biggest issue for Maguire. He is limited physically. I always think his lack of pace is a problem, and that's one of the reasons I would favour Eric Bailly against City, is that if he gets turned, you feel like he... I mean, this is the conundrum with Bailly. You feel like he's either going to give away a penalty when he gets turned, or he's going to completely clean the ball out and there's not, he's going to mop up the danger. But he does get there, is the point I'm making. He has the pace to get there. But it's mental sharpness with Maguire. He's making poor decisions on the ball is a thing in almost every match he's played. That was evident in the Spurs match as well, the number of misplaced passes he was making. So I don't really have an explanation for why he's playing this poorly, other than maybe just mentally he hasn't been allowed to reset and kind of relax himself a little bit, and he's going into every match in a little bit of a mental frenzy, which is how it looks to me. But other than that, it is a bit of a mystery. He's playing so poorly. I wouldn't, if there's an option to not play him in the derby, I would be taking that opportunity as Solskjaer. I'd be playing Bailly and Lindelof if Lindelof is fit, because obviously he's got a knock as well at the moment. So that's how bad he's playing.
A buddy of mine agrees with you. He was messaging to say that the thing that was most frustrating about the Varane injury is that it felt like that made it less likely that Harry Maguire could sit or could get a rest or whatever he might need. So yeah, we'll see if Solskjaer really rolls those dice and goes with Lindelof and Bailly, or if it is Lindelof and Maguire, or Lindelof and or Bailly and Maguire.
It's all the defender for the first goal as well, Taylor, I don't know if you noticed, is brainless. Where all four Manchester City defenders race back all the way to pretty much, you know, the six yard box without recognising the space they've just opened up in front of them, and Ilicic just drifts into it to get on the end of that pass and finishes. And a more intelligent, positionally, I mean intelligent, central midfielder might have covered that, but as we have covered a number of times on this podcast, Manchester United don't have one of those. So it just feels like they lack intelligence at the base of their midfield and in their defensive line when Varane's not there. I think Varane makes a big difference in that regard. So yeah, I'd be a little bit worried ahead of the derby from a defensive point of view.
I think it's adorable that you think I should only be a little bit worried. I would also add, I know David De Gea gets a lot of the blame for that opener. It hits off his hands and goes in. It is a little wet on the field, but I would say, Graham, to your point, that when you have the defense collapsing and then somebody kind of panic stepping at the last minute, that can lead to unpredictability in the way, like the trajectory of the ball, but it also means it's hard for the goalkeeper to see it. And I think that's kind of what happens here, is De Gea sees it late and thinks it's going one way. It has a little bit of a weird spin on it, and I think that's why he doesn't control it cleanly. Still should have done better, but I think to your point, there is something to be said for the way Manchester United sort of collapse and then try to step from there that creates openings for the opposition to score. It keeps feeling to me like almost a cartoon dam where like the little holes keep opening and you've got a person just like plugging them with their fingers, that like one game it'll be like, okay, we've got the center back situation sorted, but now there needs to be a little bit more work in the attack. Oh, no, never mind. The center back situation is now leaking again. I don't really know how you correct it, short of maybe a 4-0 win over Man City and then things are good. Joe, that feels realistic, right?
Well, I mean, I think you should just plug the holes, Taylor. I mean, right. Let's not overcomplicate this. Grab some cork or whatever you use to plug holes and just go for it, man.
Final question.
You're plugging
a
dam with cork.
We're not going to touch on that. If you want that entire dam to collapse, Joe, I think go for that one for sure. What we will mention, or at least I will ask about Graham before we finish reviewing this one. I think we can all agree that the most surprising thing about this game was the fact that it featured both Jadon Sancho and Donny van de Beek.
Yes!
Who it turns out is still alive. Graham, were you shocked to find that out?
I was shocked, but it was quite funny how Solskjaer threw them on with about 3 minutes to go, like the 86th or 87th minute. Change the game, guys, you've got 3 minutes. But the thing is, I actually felt Donny van de Beek, that's the lesser spotted wild Donny van de Beek, not the one who has sat on the bench for the last 2 years. I thought he actually did quite well. I thought he actually made a difference. Hell must be freezing over. So we'll see if that actually gets him a further opportunity or if that's him on the bench for the next 6 months.
I am now obsessed with the idea of Donny van de Beek on the pitch is Donny van de Beek in the wild, and then him on the bench is domesticated Donny van de Beek. That makes a lot of sense to me. Anything else from this game, gentlemen?
I guess we should probably talk about the contribution of Ronaldo, given that can't really figure out whether he is saving this team or ruining this team. It's kind of the discussion that overshadows all discussions with Manchester United. I suppose besides Solskjaer, it's kind of the dominating discussion around this team at the moment.
It's weird how that is the dominating discussion around him and not, say, Lionel Messi. Because I feel like it's a similar conversation we could have about this superstar player who does a lot of things well, but also creates problems and headaches for his manager. That feels pretty significant for both of them. But in this game, it is Ronaldo getting the opener and then the equalizer very late at the end. And I will toot my own horn to say that I believe I messaged you all to say Manchester United post 80th minute equalizer. Yeah. And here we are. So I think in some ways, there are problems presented. But in other ways, he is solving some of those problems himself.
Yeah, I guess the difference between him and Messi right now is that Messi actually isn't really putting up the numbers in the way that he normally does, whereas Ronaldo, I know these stats, those sort of facts are always a bit funny because without Ronaldo, United would have another striker who would likely score goals, but Ronaldo has won 5 points from United in the Champions League this season. Without his goals, they would have 2 points from 4 games and they have 7 points and are sitting top of the group. So that's what I mean. Would this team be better without him? Because it goes against the grain as a football fan and a football, pundit, writer, blogger, whatever, to suggest that taking a player out who scored so many important goals would actually make a team better. But that's the weird thing about him at the moment.
And to provide the counter argument to that, I don't really know what I believe. There have been games that Ronaldo's been huge in. I think this is one of them. Not just with his goal scoring, but the fact that he was dropping into midfield and providing an extra number there at least a few times in this game. He did it more than I'd seen from him in past games. The counter argument, though, is because of Ronaldo's lack of movement and generally his lack of intensity in the press, that you lose a lot and you don't get as much from that nine in helping your team control midfield, and you have to accommodate Ronaldo. So maybe there's a reality in which Manchester United didn't even need these goals to come back, right? Maybe different personnel and a different structure to this team without Ronaldo in the lineup would strengthen them in certain ways and would have equipped them to score goals in other ways and deny goals in other ways. So there is that argument, and we will never know, right? It's the alternate reality. We'll never actually know for sure. But I do see both sides of that argument as being pretty strong.
I know we've only got 120 minutes of evidence of this, but I think Cavani being in that United team alongside Ronaldo makes a big difference. Certainly in the Spurs game, that seemed to be the case. And Taylor, the fact that Cavani doesn't start this match, is that a sign to you that he's going to start the derby, isn't he?
My guess would have been that they would have gone for the same formation as against Spurs, and they would have tried to deploy it against Man City. With the injury to Varane, that becomes a little bit harder. I don't know if I would love three center backs of Maguire, Lindelof, and Bailly, but maybe that's the case.
What about Shaw as the left center back and Talisse as the left wing back?
I'd be fine with that. I think because it does get Cavani and Ronaldo as that front two, and I think they seem to combine well, they seem to play off each other well, but also I think that does instill a little bit of fear in defenders, and I think it keeps some defenders a little bit more honest who might otherwise be drifting forward or trying to get involved in the attack. If you can keep some numbers back for Man City and maybe make them get a little bit stretched or a little bit more open, I think that only is a benefit to Manchester United. So I would assume he starts in that game, in that derby, alongside Ronaldo. But that does then mean you're leaving out a lot of other options if you have to go that sort of formation route. So unless they're going to go with a 4-2-4 against Man City, which I think would maybe not be the smartest idea.
Oh, no.
Regardless, there's going to be some people left out in that game.
Yeah, don't go with 4-2-4 against Man City. See, especially after seeing what happened against Liverpool. Stay away from that, Ollie.
Fine. All right, rounding it out. Salzburg still on top with 7 points in Group G, despite losing 2-1 to a resurgent Wolfsburg, proving the old adage, if you need a win, fire Mark Van Bommel. Lille got a big 2-1 win on the road at Sevilla and remain in second place ahead of Wolfsburg on the narrowest of goal difference margins. And finally, there's Group H. I know that this will come as a big, big surprise, but in a group that features Juventus, Chelsea, Zenit, and Malmo, it's Juventus and Chelsea on top. Shocker. Juve now has 12 points after their win over Zenit. Chelsea are in second with 9. Pulisic, kind enough not to add insult to injury in Chelsea's defeat of Malmo, choosing to nobly miss wide instead of scoring the goal.
Yeah.
Joe, did that physically hurt you when he failed to score?
Oh, no. Taylor Wacky had a great tweet about this. You know, that Christian Pulisic is just saving his goals for moments that matter. That's all it is.
Okay.
You know, he's
okay,
just playing 4D chess out here.
It's just finite resources. He doesn't want to use them all at once.
Exactly.
For his goals on loan at North City for the second half of next season.
Graham, don't project your Scottish insecurities on me. Don't do it.
Thank you, Joe, because I was going to sit here sad. So, on that note, thanks, Graham, for being so wonderful today.
No worries.
Joe Lowry, thank you for actually being wonderful. You've both been wonderful. Joe, thank you for being here. Thank you for giving me positive signs as we await the U.S. roster release.
You got it, Taylor.
Listeners, thank you all for listening. We will be back to talk about that roster later on today and then allocation disorder tomorrow. But for now, thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.